Hi, Mark. It's good to have you again. I know we've done this interview before, and then I found that I had no recording. So thank you very much for taking the time to come through again today so that we can just have a conversation around sound engineering, you know. And for me, it is such an honor to be speaking to a Grammy Award winning sound engineer and also nominated as well, you know. So it is really a truly an honor. And for me, as I'm talking to you today, you know, I just hope I'll be able to get some nuggets to also inspire other sound engineers across Africa to desire to basically, in the sound engineering space, desire to have higher standards on themselves and also to pursue excellence. And I believe you are also one of the best people in the world that some people can be able to also learn from, because you've been at this for a while. And I believe you still continue to be at this for a while based on your track record. Yeah. So thank you for coming through today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Cool. So basically, this goes out to my podcast called Backstage Africa. And to just set the stage, I just like to know a bit about your background. So I just want to know a bit about your upbringing and how you kind of, in a way, became interested in music and sound engineering.
All right. I grew up very close to Africa, right on the other side of the Mediterranean in southern Italy, and in a region called Puglia, which is kind of across, it's the heel of the boot. It's kind of across from Montenegro, Albania, and Greece. And in this region, which has not a lot of me, didn't have a lot of music and a lot going on for itself, I opened my first recording studio when I was 17 years old after doing an internship in a recording studio where I was going to as a client, both as a musician and as a producer. And I opened this recording studio, and the scene this was in the 90s. The scene then was mostly punk hardcore in southern Italy. So I recorded a lot of punk hardcore bands, cut my teeth on that. And after about 2 or 3 years, I felt like I had hit the glass ceiling and there was nowhere else for me to go. And so I decided.
And also, just before, on that, on your first studio when you were 17, what kind of gear did you have in there?
So I had bought an analog console from the studio where I did my internship because they wanted to upgrade their console. So that was kind of the spark that lit the fire for me, because when they said, the owner of that studio said, well, you know, I'm selling this big console. It's 32 channels. It's about 6 feet long, which is about 2.5, 2 meters long. If you know anyone, let me know, he said. And I thought to myself, why would I know anyone that has that kind of space or that kind of money for a console that big? And I just kind of, you know, set the thought aside. I didn't think about it. And at night, that evening, I thought, I'm going to do it. I'm going to buy that console. I'm going to be the guy.
Yeah.
And that has set me down that path because, you know, that was my first console. Then I built a studio around the console. I built a studio with a live room and one ISO booth for vocals. And that's that's how it, and I built it in the basement of my parents' house. So they were very supportive. I had very supportive parents that helped me in my dream, which then became my career. They understood I was serious about it.
Yeah. So what kind of mic did you have coupled with this console? Or some of your very, very first mics?
Oh, I barely remember. I think I had an AKG, maybe it was called C3000, which was a condenser mic.
I know. I know.
Then, of course, I had a bunch of Shure microphones. I think I had an AKG D190. I had very basic microphones, nothing fancy. I didn't have any money, so I didn't have any fancy Neumanns or, you know, fancy condensers. Okay. I didn't have any tube mics. I just started small. The biggest thing I had was the console, and I built the studio around the console. And at that time, it was still all analog. This was before Pro Tools, so I was recording to tape, reel to reel. That was my beginning.
Yeah, and also just to backtrack just a little bit, right? I just want to know, like, how did you know, like, you know what, I'm going to do this sound engineering thing? Like, was it like straight out of school, you were like hammering on it? What were some of the things that's
not that interesting? That's a good question. I actually came from it from being a musician. I wasn't a very good musician, but I was studying piano and I was playing in different bands. I was playing keyboards in various bands, and I was only always the geek and the nerdy guy that wanted to record the rehearsals. So I bought a very old mixer, like a 16 channel mixer, and I bought a couple of mics just to record the rehearsals. And then at the time I was taking the output of the mixer and sending it to a tape deck. I had two tape decks. So I took the output of that tape deck and fed it back into the mixer so I could do a vocal overdub and record the output of the mixer into a second tape deck. So it was very rudimentary, very lo-fi, very non-professional. My next step up as a musician, still not as an audio engineer, was to buy a 4-track cassette tape recorder. It was made by Fostex. It was called X26. And it allowed you to record 4 different tracks on a small cassette tape. And that was all. At this point, I was not taking it seriously yet. It was a hobby, but it wasn't like I had not figured out that I was going to be an engineer. I was just playing around, recording the rehearsals, being a musician and having fun.
How old were you then? So this is like 16, 17.
Exactly. I was 16 at the time. The serious turn happened when I turned 17 and I was offered this console. And at this point, that was the serious turn. That's when I was like, yeah, I'm going to do this and build a studio around it.
Yeah. So you built the studio, and then after a while, you then moved to New York. What then informed that move?
As I mentioned earlier, after 2 or 3 years of recording punk hardcore bands, I felt like I hit the glass ceiling. I felt like there was nothing more I could do down in southern Italy because everything was the same. It was all punk hardcore. There was no other genres. It was all kind of the same level. And so I decided originally, I didn't think I was going to move to New York. I wanted to go to New York to do an internship to learn how other genres are recorded, to, you know, widen my horizon, so to speak. And my intention was to return to Europe and maybe move my recording studio either to Switzerland, which is where I was born, or to Northern Italy, because in Northern Italy, there is a bigger scene and more bands and more genres and more diversity. That was my intention. And then, of course, I went to New York as a 20-year-old kid, and New York, you know, my mind exploded. And I was like, there's absolutely no reason to go back. I'm going to make this my new home. And it wasn't an immediate thing. It was probably over the course of 6 months or a year, which is during the time I was doing this internship at Eastside Sound. Unpaid internship. I worked for free for two years without making any money. I had side jobs to sustain myself. I was doing some web design. Late 90s, early 2000s was like, you know, when the internet was exploding. So I was making websites to sustain myself financially.
Just on that, I think it is very key for some people also who try to come into the industry to understand the balance between pursuing the dream and also making money to also, in a way, earn a living to be able to survive, to kind of sustain the passion. Some people, they just like leave everything. They're like, they're going to pursue their dream. And then sometimes when it doesn't work out in the first few months, they kind of jump ship.
You have to be smart about it. This is a very, very hard industry. It's not easy to make a living in this industry, and it's very hard to get started in the first place. So you kind of have to have a plan B. I'm not saying you shouldn't believe in it. You have to believe in it without believing it, nothing happens, and you have to put in the work. The famous concept of the 10,000 hours is definitely true, but you have to go into it knowing that it's going to be a long uphill battle. You're going to be rowing against the current, and it's not easy. That's all I'll say. Because it's not easy, I went there with two things. I went there with savings. I had saved up money so I had money in the bank just in case something went wrong. Yeah. And I understood that I was going to be making money as an unpaid intern. What I didn't realize is that my unpaid internship was going to be 2 years long. And it was, nobody said you're going to work for free for 2 years. It's just like you work, you put in the time, and you wait for an opportunity. And my opportunity arrived 2 years later. It could have happened sooner. It could have also happened later. I basically, after 2 years of working for free, I had this opportunity to work with Luther Vandross because the main audio engineer was sick. And he called me on the morning off and he said, I'm sick. Can you take care of the session? And so I did. And so I stepped up, and that was my first session as an audio engineer.
Luther Vandross. That is amazing. Yeah.
The first time I was in the engineer's chair rather than the assistant chair, you know.
Yeah, you know, so now just looking at some of the artists that you have worked with over the years, what are some of the experiences you've had with them?
I've worked with a lot of artists.
One in particular that the last time I had an interview with you, you spoke about his work ethic. Like, I actually forgot his name, but his work ethic had a huge impact on you.
Yeah, maybe we were talking about John Zorn. It's pop because he has an incredible work ethic. He does nothing but write music and record music all, you know. He writes music every day, and we record probably on average one album every month. That's how much this guy works. He's in his 70s now. He's about to turn 70 in September. And he's been a huge influence on me because of how seriously he takes his work, how uncompromisingly he does everything. He lets nothing and no one come between him and his music. His music is king, rules his life, and everything he does is around his music. And he never stops. You know, even when we work, he doesn't take breaks. He doesn't stop to eat. He doesn't stop to have a coffee. He doesn't stop to walk outside and breathe in fresh air. He just comes into the studio and walks out 8, 10, 12 hours later without a single break. So he has uncompromising work ethic that's very inspiring to everyone.
Mm-hmm. And then some of the other artists, if you can pick like maybe three or four, that you worked with and some of the experiences you had.
Yeah, I mean, I worked with Lou Reed for 7 years. He was an amazing teacher in the sense of, you know, dedication and passion. He was very, very much into what he was doing, very detail-oriented. I worked with Nick Cave, who's one of my heroes. I didn't work very much with him, but every time when I did work with him, it was always a fantastic experience. I worked with Tyshawn Sorey, who is a very, very multidisciplinary artist. He's a drummer. That's how I first met him. He's a composer. He's a conductor. So I've worked with him in those various, stages of his life. I recorded him, you know, playing drums. Mixed shows where he was playing drums or playing the piano. He's also a piano player, a really good one. I sound designed big art installations where he was the conductor. So he has a very, very broad influence on the arts. And he was just nominated for a Pulitzer. So he's a he's a very, very serious cat that you guys should check out if you don't know him already.
Okay, cool. So you work with different genres of music, types of music. And how do you yourself approach all of these different types of projects and still be able to maintain their uniqueness and not everything sound like the same thing?
This is how. A big record collection.
Got you. Yeah, I see that.
That's only vinyl, of course. You know, I grew up listening to cassettes and then I bought CDs. I have about 5,000 CDs. And of course, now with streaming, you know, you have like unlimited access to music and you can listen to anything all the time. So that is really the key to being able to work across different genres, is understanding different genres. You cannot walk into a metal session if you've never heard a metal record. You know, you have to know the sounds that these artists are after or are trying to sound like. You have to understand the references. When they say, I want my guitar to sound like that, but I want the drums to sound like that, you have to know what they're talking about. The only way to know what they're talking about and the only way to give them what they're looking for is to have experience within the genre. So I work a lot in the worlds of rock, metal, jazz, and classical music. And those are the four genres that I also listen to at home. Those are the four genres. It's all in one booth, and I had the drums in a different booth, and I think we had the percussions in a different booth. Everything as separated as possible. It all depends. When I recorded U2, I had The Edge sitting next to me in the control room. I had Larry, I had drums and bass in the live room. I had horns in a booth, and I had Bono in another booth. So it all kind of changes from, but you have to look at the space to decide what works, and choose the space accordingly.
Gotcha. And you've been nominated 7 times. Projects that you've worked on, been nominated 7 times for the Grammys, and have won 3. You know, what does that recognition mean to you? And also, how has that impacted your career as well?
I mean, it doesn't. Obviously, it's nice to have those nominations and those wins. It doesn't change the fact that I take everything seriously. And every job, whether it's big or small, I do with the same attention to detail and the same dedication and the same level of seriousness. The only difference it makes is when you approach somebody, they have, because of those achievements, they tend to trust you they tend to be more at ease. And that's really what it comes down to. If you're working with somebody and they know what you've achieved, they tend to understand that they're in good hands and that they can trust you. And so it helps the level of trust. It's mostly that, really.
Yeah, and I've seen on your social channels, you go and watch a lot of bands, a lot of acts. You know, when my guy also did some research on you, he saw something about kite surfing and whatever other stuff, you know. So just out of interest, these hobbies of yours, do they in a way contribute, do you believe, to the person that you are as a sound engineer?
Well, kite surfing probably does not contribute to sound engineering in any way, although I do enjoy kite surfing a lot. Going to concerts most certainly does contribute to sound engineering, because it's part of the listening thing I was talking about earlier. You have to listen to a lot of things to be able to work in a lot of genres. So I go to a ton of concerts, usually 1 or 2 concerts every single night. And the reason I do that is A, because I enjoy it. I love music and I enjoy live music. I enjoy, like I was saying before, in this world of AI, where there's so much shit being peddled to us and you don't know now already, but soon you're not going to know what's real and what's not. Live music is going to be the most real expression of artists that remains, the most authentic way to know if an artist can really deliver. I enjoy that now. I've enjoyed it in the pre-AI world, and I will enjoy it even more in the AI world. It will become even more important. So, yeah, I enjoy going to concerts, and it helps me understand, obtain a broader understanding of music as a whole. And so, yes, it certainly does contribute a lot to being a sound engineer.
100%. And I think this is going to be one of my last official questions. You know, so you've had a long and successful career, you know, and working with some of the biggest names, you know. What would you say to someone, you know, coming into the space? You know, what would you advise them? What advice, recommendations, or words of wisdom would you give them?
Well, like I said earlier, you have to enter this world knowing that it's a very, very hard uphill battle. And you have to be ready for that. You have to have the tools. By tools, I mean the knowledge, but also the dedication, the passion, and the willingness to put in the 10,000 hours. Because without those 10,000 hours, you're not going to be as good as somebody that's put in the 10,000 hours. It's a community, and you have to work within a community. And by community, I mean a community of engineers, but also community of artists. We're all part of the same artistic community. We all hopefully support each other. And it's very important to have that kind of... I'm friends with tons of engineers. It's not a competition. It's a community in which we serve the music. And it's important to do that. It's important to serve the music. But without getting too, you know... philosophical. If you were talking about more down to earth practical terms, I would say have a plan B and do everything you can to stick to plan A. Because plan A is hard, and so plan B is there just in case. But plan A is requires a lot of time and a lot of dedication. But if you do it, and if you believe in yourself and you find a way to sustain yourself, then, you know, put in everything you got. Like Rick Rubin said in an interview I've heard, he's one of my heroes and inspirations. If you have to sustain yourself doing something, if in order to do your art, and by art, you can be an artist, but in my case, it's engineering, it's mixing, and that's also an art. If you have to do another job to do that, that's fine. The important thing is not how you make money. The important thing is that you get to do your art. And so focus on that, and then the rest will come.
100%. Thank you for that. You know, it's been amazing having this interview with you. On my time, I'm on 2 minutes, 47 seconds, counting down. Our 30-minute interview, so we are like on time. I just want you to do a quick shout out to sound engineers across Africa. Just say hi to them. From right now, you are in New York. Where are you right now?
Yeah, I'm in New York.
Okay, cool. Yeah, just pass greeting to sound engineers across Africa from New York. I would appreciate that.
Yeah, I actually know a few engineers in Africa because I've worked with a couple of African artists like Zoe Modiga. I don't know if you know her. She's fantastic.
I know her.
I mixed her last record or the one before the last, and she actually won an African Music Award. I forget what the name of the award is, but is in that African award... I don't remember what it's called. I think it was before the pandemic or during or right after the pandemic. But anyway, in that African Music Awards, me and the other engineer that did the recording in Africa, you know, we're very happy to be to be working together. So he did all the recording and I did all the mixing. Nice. So hello to all the engineers out there in Africa. I wish you all the best and, you know, keep up the good work and make sure you record, you know, the best way you can, the best way you have available with whatever gear you have available. Just always do it as good as you can.
100%. And I think the last thing was you did sound for one of the Grammy Awards events this year. Can you just talk a little bit on that?
Yeah, this year and last year, and hopefully next year, I have mixed Grammy premiere ceremony in Los Angeles. Well, this year in Los Angeles. Last year it was in Las Vegas. And it's basically the event where they give out all the Grammy Awards, all the categories that you don't see on TV are being awarded. And there's a live band, which is incredible, which is helmed, conducted, and arranged by Cheche Alara, who's an Argentinian composer, conductor, piano player. It's a incredible band that plays, you know, has to learn 90 cues in a couple of days and play them, you know, on a four count. And it's a pleasure for me to mix that band. It's a big band. It's 15 or 20 people, I forget, with horns and strings and like drums and, you know, percussion, everything. So mixing that band is so much fun. And they basically play after every one of the single awards, they play like 90 tunes very briefly. And so I'm mixing this band. I'm also mixing the microphones on stage of the people accepting the awards or being introduced. So it's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of work. It's very fast paced, but it's a great experience and really fun to do.
No, beautiful. Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate you taking your time. I really look forward, you know, different times whenever we find times and opportunities, we have conversations, even more focused on like different elements, you know. But for today, Mark, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. May you enjoy the rest of your day. I think there's still morning over here now. It's like I'm just getting into my evening now. Yeah.
All right.
Then,
yeah.
It was the end of my day. Yeah.
I have a mixing session in an hour, so I'm gonna go to the studio next.
Okay. Cool. All the best. Thank you very much again. I thank you all the way here from South Africa, from Backstage Africa. Thank you, Mark.
All right. Take care, guys.